name is Ken Fallon, and today's episode of Hacker Public Radio, I'm going to talk about setting up a secure private data cloud solution where I use Ursync over SSH to back up my data to a remote location. Over the last few years, I've stopped using an analog camera and an analog video camera, and as a result, you know, I don't print out photos anymore because, you know, the reel is never full as such, which kind of explains why my parents don't have any recent picture of the kids. But you gotta realize, if you're in this situation as well, you gotta ask yourself the question, well, how secure and safe is my data? Because up until this point, basically, if your hard disk crashed, there wasn't really that much stuff on it that was going to be important. Maybe you had a backup CD of a few documents that you had, but, you know, maybe you needed to recreate your CV or whatever, or your resume. So things have changed though now, because the only copy of your cherished photos are going to be on that computer, and the only memories of the videos of your kids are going to be on that hard disk. And over recent times, as the capacity of hard disks have increased, the reliability has decreased. And they're doing an awful lot of tricks on the controller to make sure that they, as data sectors fail, that they're moved seamlessly to another location. But you can't really trust that. I've included a PDF study done at Google, and it shows the reliability failure of data disks over time, you know, from 2% up to 50%, and within 5 years, you can more or less be guaranteed that your hard disk is going to fail. So, you know, what was worrying there as well in that study was that the smart monitoring tools that are supposed to report the health of the hard disk, in many of the cases, they didn't. So you probably won't even have any warning until it's too late that something's going wrong. And traditionally, the way we've backed up stuff is we copy the important files onto a CD, or, you know, copy a few documents and a few spreadsheets onto a USB stick, and we're happy out. But those mediums themselves, I've already spoken about this, are unreliable and degrade over time. DV video from 4 years ago is already bad. DVDs and CDs get corrupted and it's difficult to read them. Worse is the SD cards. If they fail, that's it. Goodbye, Kalala. There's nothing left. You're in big trouble. But the fact of the matter is, the capacity of these backup mediums are okay for a few documents, but when you're talking about photos and videos, especially when we're talking about HD stuff, there isn't enough disk capacity to be able to cover this. So the problem is that data capacity has increased, hard disk capacity has increased, but the backup, the means to backup this, hasn't. So of course, the solution of this is the problem is to go out and buy yourself even more hard disks. And you can pick up a 1.5 terabyte hard disk from Amazon. I just checked there and it was $95, and equivalent over here in Europe, a 1 terabyte for €70 from Micom.nl. So basically, the solution to this problem of hard disk failing is a juggling act where you move data from one to the other, and you as hard disks fail, you replace them. So you're looking at something like a mirroring array where everything is written to both disks, and if one fails, you still have the backup, or a RAID 5 array where you've got three or more disks where if one fails, there's enough information on the other two to be able to recreate the third. Now, there are also proprietary solutions out there like a Drobo, which is an all-in-one unit, and you just can connect it to the network. But there are also sub-100 euro dollar NAS solutions, network attached storage solutions. My brother has a HP one that runs Debian, and I've just seen a few, seen them every week, small little low power devices that can take serial ATA hard disks and will automatically mirror them, you know, no thinking required. So if you've got that in your home, then at least, you know, the failure, the risk of one hard disk failing is kind of eliminated, or at least minimized somewhat. You've got to be keeping an eye on to make sure that if one hard disk fails, that you notice it so that you can replace it in time. So you got to do your homework still. Okay, so you've got a good solution, but as any good sysadmin will tell you, there is no such thing. RAID and mirroring are not backup solutions. They're you still have to have a backup solution, and in this case you've got to have an offsite backup solution, because what if somebody comes in and you know, or there's a power outage and it accidentally fries all the disks, so your network attack storage blows up and goes on fire, or somebody comes in and steals them, or there's a flood or whatever. So you really want to have an offsite strategy, and a lot of this stuff has been around for, you know, these concepts have been around for years, but they've been limited to like banks or wherever. But now you have important data that's stored only electronically. You got to make sure that it is replicated to offsite locations. And what you can do, the first thing that springs to mind is something like a Gmail drive or a Ubuntu One or Dropbox, and even the Twit network I'd add for Carbonite Pro there for a while. But the problem with those solutions is they're good for the USB sticky type amounts of data. But you start talking about the amount of data I'm talking about, so I've got a quarter to a half of terabyte, and you're looking at $100 per month. And, you know, the price of a 1 terabyte hard disk itself is $100. So it's far more economical to simply just buy one or more disks and have them in an offsite location. And by offsite location, I mean a family member or a friend or some guy in work or acquaintance or colleague, you know, your parents if they have broadband, your brother if they've got broadband, your sister, whatever. It makes a lot more sense to put your data over there rather than paying these prices. And what I've heard about some of these solutions is that the cost of uploading data is quite cheap, but you really paid through the nose when your data is gone and you need to download it, because then they have you by the short and curlies basically, and you have to pay outrageous amounts to get your data back. So the solution then is to buy more hard disks and just to put them in different locations and use rsync to replicate the data from your NAS or your RAID solution or your server or whatever, we'll call it your NAS, replicate that via rsync over SSH to the remote location. Now, before I get into anything else, I want to say there's like a degree of trust involved in this on both sides. First of all, you got to trust that on the other side, they're not going to be looking at your private and confidential data. And on our side, you've got to take into account the fact that the person they're going to have access to a machine on the inside of your network, and they may be able to access files and your files as well, or they may be able to set off processes that might get you in trouble with the law. Now, the way around this, of course, the way around the looking at the files would be to use encrypted disks, and to place, instead of shipping just a hard disk, you ship one of these low-cost server NAS servers with just enough of an OS that it boots up and, you know, gets an IP address, registers with dynamic DNS or whatever, and notifies you, and that you can SSH in and mount an encrypted drive. So that gets over that problem. But it doesn't actually get you over the problem of somebody having a machine and doing nasty stuff on your side of the network. So proceed with caution. But, you know, if it's a family member, there's a level of trust there. So I wasn't actually that concerned about that, to be honest with you. So what you're going to do is, you know, if you both have newly provisioned disks and you don't have a lot of space, or you don't have a lot to synchronize, you probably have enough space to just go ahead and begin the synchronization. But if you do, you might want to consider buying a disk, you buying the disk that's going to be in the other location, putting the data on it, and then shipping it physically, because the way rsync works is it's a bit like a copy on the initial run. So you copy all the data from the source to the destination, and then subsequently any changes are made by rsync. So you're never going to copy everything over again, or at least you shouldn't. If you are copying stuff over again, it could be that something's wrong. Like I had a case where the parameter I was using was specifying that the user, that you should check the user ID and the group ID to make sure that they were correct, and if not, modify them. So it was recopying files over, because the user ID and group ID I was using on the other side was different. So anyway, all that got fixed. So what I suggest you do on the first run is to use Sneakernet, where you physically put it on a physical drive, put the physical drive in the post, the post person, DHL or wherever, ships it off to the other side, and then you put it in, and then you can just synchronize the changes after that. So that's a nice convenient solution. Also, another tip, if you're synchronizing from a Unix system to a Windows system, you're going to lose some of your some of the file attributes. So users, permissions, and that sort of thing will be lost. So if you can, it's better to keep it between Unix systems. You can, of course, if you're not worried about that, you know, permissions or whatever, you're just actually worried about the files themselves, you can happily go out, and rsync will support or syncing between Unix and Windows. Okay, the command. So now, in our hypothetical situation here, we bought an additional 1 terabyte disk. It's been shipped to your home. You plug it into your NAS server, and it has been mounted as /media/disk. So the rsync command is, and I'll go through these one by one afterwards, is rsync -vva --dry-run --delete --force, and then the source and destination, which in my case is /data/autosync /media/disk. So the first one is always the source, so /data/autosync is the source, and then the second one is also always the destination, /media/disk. Now the dry run in there, as you can probably guess, is to make sure that you'll only go through the motions of copying it. It'll give you all the messages or error messages of what it's going to do, but it doesn't actually do it. And that's very, very useful on your first synchronization. It's a very good idea when you're starting this for the first time to put in some test directories, both on the source and on the destination, and use those until you're sure you've got the syntax down and correct. And in those directories, I'd usually have identical files on both sides, files with the same name with different file size, files with the directories with different file size, directories on one that aren't on the other, and then run the command. And with that command, you should see what's going on both sides. So let's go through the command here. Rsync, the -vv is the sets the verbosity level, which increases the amount of information given during the transfer. 1V is a small amount of information. The more V's you add, the more information you get. Then the dry run is, you know, don't perform any changes. The delete will be delete any files on the destination that are not in the source. And the force will also delete empty directories on the destination that are not in the source. This is where my warning comes. You got to be careful when transferring this data that you don't accidentally overwrite anything, because if you accidentally put /media/disk /data/autosync, what it would do is look, oh, there's a lovely new empty an empty hard disk here, and he wants me to synchronize it over with that big location over there with all those files and folders. And I've been told to force and delete. Then, well, okay, I'll go and delete everything over there on all my videos and photos are now gone officially. No way to get them back. So be careful about what you're doing. Might be no harm at this point to mount the destination, do it through a loopback, and mount that drive or that section of your device via read-only share, so that the chance of that happening is minimized. Because in this setup, rsync supports, you know, synchronizing two ways and, you know, keeping things in synchronization. But in this case, what you're doing is you're just replicating it out. Your NAS server is always going to be the master, you know, in case some, or, you know, unless you need to get the information back, but it's always going to be the master. So the assumption here is that if a file is not on the master, then delete it from the slave. If it's on the master, then put it to the slave, that sort of thing. Okay, then we have the only other one that's left is the dash A command, which actually stands for dash RLPTGO, all in lowercase, and then capital D. And those are links, recreate the links and symlinks on the destination, recreate permissions, times, groups, and owners on the destination. And the capital D is transfer character, block, device files, name sockets, and FIFO. So basically all the special files. So once you're happy, you know what you're doing, you've done your test directory, you're now doing a dry run against your read-only copy of the your data drive, then the thing that you can do is drop the dry run and then actually do the synchronization to your hard disk. And depending on the amount of data, it might take a while to synchronize because it needs to do checksums on everything. But actually, it mightn't take that long because there's no destination, so there's no comparison going on. So the next step might be to ship off the disk to the remote location and then set up rsync over SSH. But I prefer to have an additional testing step where I rsync over SSH to a PC in the home. So I'll take the disk that we've already rsynced, put it into a laptop, set all the SSH stuff up just like I want it on the remote location, just to make sure everything's working. The steps to do this are going to be exactly the same as what we've done before, so you can work along. Now, what you need to do on your NAS server is you're going to need to generate a new SSH public and private key pair that has no password associated. And the reason you're going to do this is that you want the synchronization to occur automatically, so you don't need to be able to access the remote system without having to enter a password. If you do have a SSH key already, it's probably got a password on it, so you don't want to be there in the middle of the night trying to type your password to get this script going. Now, there are security concerns about passwordless SSH keys. Anyone on that NAS whose root on that NAS device of yours will be able to get to that key, and then will be able to SSH to the other location. But kind of seeing as you're the user, it's your NAS device, I'm assuming that this is a minor security concern. So once you've generated your keys, you probably want to call them something different than the normal one. I use rsync-key, so I know what they are. So I'll have rsync-key and then rsync-key.pub. And I just take the contents of that .pub file and I add it to the end of the authorized key files on my laptop and on the remote PC. Do both at the same time so you get the SSH issues worked out. And I've got a link in the show notes to Jeremy Mates's website that has more information on how you can go through all this. This has also been covered on the HPR network before, so I'm not going to go into it too much. So once you have the keys generated and the public key copied over to the authorized key files on both laptops, you're going to want to SSH into them. And the only trick here from a normal SSH is that you need to use the dash I to specify the new name of the SSH key. So it's ssh-i/home-user.ssh rsync key and then the normal space user at example.com. If this is the first time you've logged into that machine from the NAS server, your NAS server, as the user that you're going to do the rsync, you're going to need to type in yes so that they SSHD keys from the other side are going to be added to the .ssh known host file. So it makes sense to actually log in as that user so that that is done. So now you've got the keys on your laptop and you've also got them on the remote location and you've got a console up. So that's very good. You might want to just create a file on both locations to make sure you can create files, delete that file again to make sure you can delete files. So then that's the SSH part about it. That's the SSH part done. So we're going to put both of those two commands together into the rsync command, and the end command, this will all be in the show notes as well, is rsync-va space delete space force-e, and this is the new bit. The dash e tells rsync to use this shell, which is ssh-i/home-user.ssh/rsync-key, double quotes, space, and then the source, which is /data-autosync, that's the same, and the destination has changed, so it'll be space user@example.com :autosync. So that means the SSH user at the DNS name or IP address. All going well, there should be no updates, but you may want to try adding, deleting, and modifying files on both ends to make sure the process is working correctly. Now, when you're happy, you can ship the disk to the other side. The only requirement is that the other network SSH is allowed through the firewall to your server, and that you get a well-known public IP address. If you don't have a static IP address, then you can use services like Dynamic DNS, or there's a range of them. Again, there'll be a link in the show notes to where you can get that. And you should be able to SSH to your server like before. If you're not able to connect to the server over port 22, say for example the person you're peering with has already got port 22 in use, you can use you can specify a port option in your string to connect in on an additional port. So but the whole point of this synchronization is that it should be seamless, so you want your rsync to be running constantly, and the easiest way to do this is just start a screen session and then run the command that we've given above into a simple loop, and that has the advantage of getting you off quickly, but it's kind of not very resilient to reboots. So I've created a simple script which I put in user local bin autosync, and it's got the /bin bash while true do date, and then the rsync string exactly as it was before, then date, and then sleep 3600, and then done. And what that does is the while true do loop, look at my last episode on bash loops about that. So it puts it into an infinite loop. It puts a date at the beginning of the rsync and a date at the end of the rsync so that I can see, you know, when it ran last, and then it sleeps for an hour, so I'm not flooding either side of the script. So I take that and I put it into a cron tab, and you should see my last episode about cron for more information on cron. And my cron tab file is available cron tab space dash l, and I've got uppercase mail to equals double quote, so an empty mail to line. I've got 0 space 1 asterisk 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 space timeout space 540000 space user local bin autosync, and then I redirect standard output to temp autosync.log, and I redirect standard error to also temp autosync.log. Now, those of you among us may be thinking, well, he's put a script with an infinite loop into a cron tab. Surely the script is going to be respawned every night, and at the end of the year I'm going to have 365 of these scripts running and chewing up my resources. And the answer to that would be yes, that is correct, except for the fact that I'm calling the script not from cron. I'm calling the command that's actually calling the script is the IBM command, or the command written by the IBM dudes, which is called timeout. And what timeout does is it terminates any application after a particular period of time. So if you want to run a movie for a particular period of time, playlist, and then stop it at a particular time, you put the timeout and then the number of seconds until you want it to stop, and then it'll kill the process. It's actually very nice, a very nice utility, just a little tool, short sweet, does something. And the reason I did this is that rsync does have a patch that allows you to specify what times it runs and what time it doesn't, but this is a very quick and simple means to prevent rsync running during the evening, so that it allows my brother to come home and browse the network, you know, from 4 o'clock in the evening to midnight, and then my rsync script starts again at 1 o'clock and continues to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 1 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then it terminates. So the script will run infinitely from 1 o'clock, stop after 1 o'clock, stop at two, stop at three, four, five, six, and all the way around, and then gets terminated. Now, the reason for the male two equals double quotes is that the, although I'm redirecting the output of autosync to a log file, the timeout itself is run in a separate process because you don't want to terminate the application and then timeouts gets terminated and it doesn't kill the other one. So that will then add entries into your crontab file every time that runs. It's not too serious. So the mail to basically means you're not getting emailed. If you're doing this with somebody else, they might not have a problem with you running 24/7 so long as you can throttle the bandwidth. And rsync does have a switch called dash dash bandwidth limit and then equals, and then you put in the kilobits per second a value. And that will limit all rsync copies to that bandwidth. So you might set it at 10% of the total download bandwidth of the person that you're syncing to. You can, so that is quite nice. So that's basically that with regard to rsync. I probably made the whole thing sound a lot more scary and complicated than it is. Whatever, you can choose to do this or not. If there's something you're taking away from the show, is that you should have some system where everybody in your home network saves a file. It's going to get saved to some mirrored or backed up solution, and then that is going to be sent to an offsite location. In this case, I've done it with one brother. I'm working on the process of doing it with two or possibly three of my other brothers. So that there will be, there's no reason why this rsync script can't replicate to more locations. The more the better. Now, I would like to take some time out at the end of this podcast to mention another podcast which I'd like to recommend, and that's called Screencasters, and it's at heathenx.org. I'll just give you a little extract from their about page. The goal of screencasters.heathenx.org is to provide a means through a simple website of allowing new users in the Inkscape community to watch some basic and intermediate tutorials by the authors of this website. So Heathenx and Richard Quirin have produced a show that puts a lot of professional tutorials to shame. I have sat through some very, very sad episodes of videos that I've purchased through work, but theirs are an actual joy to watch. I've been watching them from episode one on the train on my Acer Aspire 1, every evening coming home on the train, and quite often you see people looking over my shoulder, looking at what I'm looking at. They even have, you know, they go through the whole gamut of everything that Inkscape can do, which is a drawing program, if you didn't know. They even have mini tutorials that will get you started, like this is the interface, this is the menu bar, this is where you can find this, this is where you can find that. After watching the entire episodes, I'm now looking at posters and work and ads and all sorts of things, going, oh, that's how they did that, and you see that effect there, and this logo or this icon on this application is done like that. So it's really, really cool. Even if you're not interested in graphics, like, it's something you want to download. If you know somebody who's using Photoshop or something else, you know, burn some of these onto a DVD and hand it over to them, and put a copy of Inkscape on there. It runs on Windows as well, so yeah, good stuff. So that is my recommendation for a podcast for this month. And with that, I'll bid you adieu and wrap this one up, and hope that you will take some time out of your busy day to record a show. I'm very interested in hearing other episodes from other people. With that, thank you very much, and talk to you again. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.